morning and welcome to What We Lose in the Shadows,
a father-daughter true crime podcast.
My name is Jameson Keys.
I'm Caroline. Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Caroline?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm good. Today I wanted to discuss two incidents that have happened over the years, one really recent and one fairly recent, just a few years ago, in two different countries, but with the same underlying hatred causing them, which is transphobia. So transphobia, just to define it for anyone who may not know, is hatred or abuse or even just thoughts of trans people being less than simply because they are transgender or gender nonconforming.
Gotcha.
So it's about gender identity, not about gay, sexual orientation, lesbianism. It's not related to that. Although sometimes people do feel more open to being that. So I think sometimes there's overlap.
Right.
But it's about gender expression. So two cases that have happened in recent years. One was Brianna Jai, which was actually supposed to be our second recording.
Right.
But I just needed to gather my thoughts on it. I wanted to give it some time and wait and see about the sentencing for the two murderers who were also children, which is crazy. Both of these cases are about transgender youth that were murdered by classmates.
Doubly tragic.
It's not just ridiculous.
Not just the death of the person, but also the fact that young people actually committed these crimes.
It's disgusting. So Brianna Jai, her case was finished sentencing about a few weeks ago, I believe. And then one that recently happened a few weeks ago was Nex Benedict, a young child in Oklahoma, and Brianna Jai was in the UK. I'll be discussing that in the next episode. So watch out for that.
You know what? This is something that is a much lighter note than that.
Trigger warnings for today are domestic terrorism and bomb threat.
All right, Caroline. So this is actually, although it sounds on the face of it like it's going to be a much worse kind of an episode, but it really isn't. Have you
I'm
ever
glad
heard
to hear
the
that.
Name? Yeah, really.
It's far and few between in these crime spaces.
That's exactly right. Have you ever heard the name D.B. Cooper?
No.
Okay.
Unless you're talking about Debbie Cooper from what's that one show? Oh my goodness. River High.
Was that the reworking of Archie comics?
Debbie Cooper was the mom, also married to a serial killer.
Lovely. That's a lovely.
Anyway, so not related to that, Debbie Cooper.
Yeah. And the comic books really weren't related to that story arc either. Anyways, so D.B. Cooper is totally different. So on a cloudy afternoon in November of 1971, so when I was 8 years old.
Oh my God, you were alive? Just kidding.
So a well-dressed middle-aged man boarded a Northwest flight number 305, leaving Portland, Oregon. And soon after the plane took off, the man calmly alerted the flight attendant that he had a bomb wired inside of his briefcase. He also communicated the ransom demand
for police. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Before 9/11, did they literally not even check your bags?
You know, that's an interesting point. This very case triggered a lot of this, them really looking through your
but
case.
Before that, they literally didn't even check your bags.
You know, I wasn't traveling in 1971, so okay. I didn't know exactly what the protocol was.
What the fuck?
By the time I started flying, you know, in the 80s, late 80s, yeah, you went through metal detectors and they checked your bags and all that kind of x-ray scan. But at this point in time, I do not believe that that was the case.
So what's the difference between the 80s when you were like traveling? You were really traveling. You were a flight attendant.
I was a flight attendant. Yes,
was it
I was
80s or 90s?
You were a flight attendant. Late 80s through 90s. The mid 90s.
So during that time, compared to 9/11, what what changed? Like, because if you said there were already like metal detectors back then and they were looking through bags.
So at this point in time, during the period where this happened, like from 1969 to 1970, call it three or four, there were literally hundreds of hijackings. And that's what this was. This Dan Cooper boarded the plane and eventually ended up with over $200,000 in cash from the police. And literally hundreds of these things happened. It was almost commonplace.
That's insane.
Well, and the thing was, the difference between that and something as really tremendously upping the scale was the fact that most of the cases were an inconvenience for the passengers, but ordinarily involved them landing somewhere, then bringing a sum of money on board, and then the hijacker requesting that, and it could have been that, or it could have been the person actually robbed a bank or something, got on a commercial plane and pulled a gun or said he had a bomb and made them fly to Mexico where there wasn't really good extradition. It was a way of getting...
That is insane.
It truly is insane.
What?
And the fact that a lot of people were like, you know, just come, oh, shit. You know, and weren't terrified because this person had a gun or a bomb or whatever. And a lot of times they didn't actually have anything, but just the claim of it, the police kind of, you know, at that point in time, this is pre-9/11, pre-terrorist wars and all that kind of stuff. There is a much more kind of a genteel time in terms of, you know, well, if he says he had a bomb, we're not going to risk the fact, you know, that he may have a bomb. Now, what also happened was, I think it was in the late 80s that Pan Am Flight, I believe it was, blew up over Lockerbie, Scotland, that had a bomb in a suitcase that was in the bottom of the plane and killed a whole lot of people.
Ugh.
But this was much, much less, you know, much less scary, really. The man who used the name Dan Cooper boarded the plane. And like I said, he ended up with about $200,000 in cash from the police. After requesting that the crew take off again, and when they brought the cash on board, right, he had them fly the plane at a certain...
I like how you say request, as if it was like, would you mind if you just...
Well, that's just it. Apparently, according to a lot of the flight attendants and some of the people that were dealing with this guy, he came on board and he was dressed... He was debonair. He was actually in a nice suit and had a white shirt and a black tie and a tie clip on it and so on, came on with a nice pair of sunglasses on. The flight attendant actually said he looked more like James Bond than, you know, kind of a, you would never expect this is a guy that's going to cause trouble.
So I can't assume.
That's exactly right. So he did have them take off again, right? And they flew for a while, and then something really unexpected happens. So anyways, here are a few interesting facts about that, okay? The incident remains the sole unsolved case of air piracy involving a commercial airliner in the United States. So witnesses describe the man as having jumped out of the airplane after the second takeoff.
What?
And disappearing without a trace. Numerous theories surround the identity and, you know, of the proposed hijacker. Some say that he was Richard Floyd McCoy, and, you know, he was responsible for that crime.
So did he jump out with a parachute?
He did.
Okay.
When he made the request of the cash, he also requested four parachutes be brought on board. Now, that should have told someone something, right? But they brought the cash, they took off, he had the parachutes and so on. And so in 1972, this man, McCoy, hijacked a commercial airline, once again, demanded $500,000 in a ransom. And before parachuting out of the plane, very reminiscent of D.B. Cooper, McCoy was apprehended later and killed after escaping from prison. He was never definitively linked to the Cooper case, although it sounds really familiar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, left the FBI with lingering doubts. Other suspects included Kenneth Christensen, identified by his brother as Cooper.
That's a good identifier.
Due to a striking resemblance to the FBI's composite sketch, and Jack Caulfield, who claimed to be Cooper after sustaining a leg injury in Portland during that time period. Despite numerous leads, no suspect has been conclusively proven as D.B. Cooper.
That is so weird.
In 2016, the FBI officially suspended the case. So, like you said before, how does someone walk on and do that? And was he some sort of a raving madman or something like that? He was not. His description sounded, like I said, more like James Bond. part of the sensation around D.B. Cooper and the hijacking is because it sounded so smooth. The official FBI bulletin was released to describe him as a white male in his mid-40s with olive skin, appearing to be well-spoken, intelligent, you know, in his demeanor and so on, wearing a dark suit with a white shirt and a black tie, carrying a briefcase that they didn't check, obviously.
What the fuck?
And sometimes wearing sunglasses. According to one witness, and that was the flight attendant, Flora Schaefer, Cooper was calm and even ordered two bourbons during the flight. Cooper even paid his bill for the bourbon.
What the fuck?
And wanted Schaefer to keep the change.
That is so weird.
He also calmly explained his plans to the pilots. He needed them to follow his instructions so that he could jump safely from the plane. To complete the round out of James Bond appeal and appearance, Cooper ended up hijacking a plane and then jumping out of the back. Now, let me explain how that happened. As you said, I was a flight attendant at one point in time, and we were still flying the same plane that this guy was flying at that time. It was called a 727. Your grandfather actually used to fly that plane. Mm. One of the interesting features of the plane was you come through the doors, you know, on the front end of a plane, you know, and even there's two to four overwing exits as well. And then sometimes in the back of the plane, there are exits back there too. This plane was kind of supposed to be revolutionary when they built it in that it didn't need necessarily a jetway, because back between the engines in the very back of the plane where the tail cone is, you could open that and then lower the stairs, okay? So you could board the plane on places that didn't have a formal jetway. And it's a pretty good-sized plane. It probably held 140, 150 people. So, but I do remember during training of that, that there was something that it actually changed the way people fly. They called it the D.B. Cooper device.
Oh, my God.
And what it did was it made it so you could not, in flight, open the back stairways. Because that's exactly what this guy did. He had them fly at about 10,000 feet. Okay. Then they lowered the back staircase. And, of course, at that point in time, 10,000 feet, he got on board the flight at 4. After all the circling around, and by the way, when they landed the plane the first time and bought the money on board, they evacuated the other passengers, telling them there was a mechanical problem with the plane.
They didn't even know.
They didn't even know that they were potentially, you know, their life was in danger and so on. And because this guy was so calm, and the police didn't come rushing in because it looked very much like he had a bomb. And I can't remember if there actually was dynamite in this case or if there wasn't, but if it just looked that way, the police weren't taking any chances. So they take up the second time. They get up to 10,000 feet. They told him to fly towards Mexico, and that's where their flight plan was. But a few minutes after that, Cooper lowered the back stairways, jumped out of the plane. Now, at that point in time, it's 8:30 in the evening. Not only that, but it's November. It was a thunderstorm in that area at that point in time, and they were flying over a forested area. So this guy had four parachutes. He chose one. He took the, I don't know, about 30 or 40 pounds of bills, wrapped them and tied it around his chest, and physically just jumped out of the plane.
And they never found him?
No, they never found him.
I feel like he probably died, because typically with the, what do you call it? Parachute. Typically when you parachute, you have to land in like a place that's flat and void of trees.
So that led a lot of speculation in terms of who this guy was. And they brought four different types of parachutes. Some were modern, some were not, right? The one he chose, mm-hmm. If you've ever seen the movies where they have these two little cords on the side of the parachute, so you can kind of steer the parachute. He chose one that didn't have the guides on it.
Okay.
So some people thought or assumed that was because he had no idea what he was doing, mm-hmm. right? And he just picked one chute and jumped out of the plane. Other people have thought this guy was an experienced paramilitary jumper. And that's what you jump with out of a plane. You don't steer those if you're jumping off of a ring. So no one knows exactly which one it is, right? Hmm. Was he a fool? And when he jumped out into that thunderstorm over a really, really rugged part, you know, of the Washington, you know, forest there, did he fall to his death?
Yes, I think he did.
Or didn't he?
He probably did. Because, I don't know. I think like we, especially like Americans, but like I think in general, like people love to entertain the idea of like a overly intelligent like criminal. And it's like, that's not really all that common. Like most of the time, these criminals are really stupid. Like mm-hmm. they really are just like doing whatever, just trying to get like the ends to a means then, you know what I mean? And so I don't know, to assume that he had military background, this, that, whatever, like, I don't know. I just, how likely is that?
Well, so where he jumped out was in a dense forest near Mount St. Helens, which years later would, you know, blow up.
Oh.
But in Washington. And this one gentleman who was an experienced paramilitary rigger claimed that there's no way jumping out of a plane at that speed in pitch darkness that this guy possibly landed it.
Yeah. See, that's what I mean. It's just like, cause when you see, I'm not an experienced, I've never been parachuting and I'm not like, I don't research this kind of thing, but what I've seen is they typically land in like a flat environment, like a field. Mm-hmm. And I just can't imagine that going well with like a bunch of like, what, 20, 40 foot evergreens. Like it just, you know what I mean? Like you're going to get stuck in those trees.
Well, so here's another thing, really mm-hmm. interesting thing. Although there were multiple planes tailing the 727 when it was flying, right?
Yeah.
No one saw him leave the plane.
What do you mean? No one saw him jump?
No one saw him jump.
But it was dark.
It was dark, you know, or it was getting dark, right? Mm-hmm. But no one actually saw him jump. So some people say he hid somewhere on the plane and then just walked out of the airport and so on. But that's probably the least likely.
What the hell?
But people over the years have come up, you know, and claimed to be D.B. Cooper or claimed that they, you know, knew someone who knows. And the interesting thing is a few years later, I think it was 1980, a young boy was walking near a riverbed. And this was in February of 1980. An 8-year-old boy was on vacation near Vancouver, Washington, and uncovered some of the bills that were actually from that heist.
How? Where was it?
He was walking along kind of the sandy portion of a beach on a riverbank, and he saw something in there, and he started kicking it around, and he noticed that it was actually money.
And it was where?
Just near a riverbank, on a riverbank, and kind of partially buried. So that led people to, you know, speculate that that he had perished and it just blew away.
I think so.
But it also had some people speculate that was able to somehow land this thing, buried some of the money there.
Was it just buried because, like, time and, you know what I mean? Like, was it buried under, like,
that would have been 9 years
dirt?
Later.
Okay, right. So it could have been buried for that reason, you know?
Yeah.
Like dirt.
This guy didn't have like a backpack or anything that he put the money in. They brought him in this bags of money, which he tied around him and dove out of the plane.
Oh, my God.
So the kid actually recovered. The kid actually recovered, I don't know, like if they were, I don't know, $100 bill stacks containing 90 bills. He actually resold the money in 2008 in an auction and made $37,000 on it.
That's awesome.
But it you know, this inspired like 15 different copycats, right? And some of the interesting ones, I thought, you know, there was one guy that tried to hijack another plane. This is another hijacker. Like I said, this was happening all the time. This was in like 1979, I think, right? Okay. Or in the late 70s. And his name was Frederick Honnerman. And he hijacked a plane and departed from Allentown, Pennsylvania, and demanded that the flight fly to Dulles International Airport in D.C. To be fulfilled with his ransom requirements. $303,000 in cash, cigarettes, food, parachutes, knives, fuel, and a crash helmet.
And what did he think that helmet was going to do? Okay.
That's a great point. But once his conditions were met, Honnerman allowed the passengers to get off the plane, almost all of them except for the flight crew. Then he ordered the captain to take off. However, soon after, he changed his mind. Because they had given him all $100 bills and they seemed to be sequential. So he asked them to go back down and change the denominations of the money and, you know, so they weren't, you know, sequential and maybe weren't tracked and that sort of thing. Once he had that, they took off again. And then this gentleman had them fly to Honduras.
And they landed in Honduras?
So they flew to Honduras. And before they actually got there, Hunterman jumped out of the plane.
Oh, my God.
And in the dead of night, he landed in the jungle deep, you know, away from the plane, right?
Oh, my God.
Clutching his hard-earned ransom. For weeks, he evaded capture, but eventually he turned himself to the U.S. Embassy in Honduras.
Literally, that's my point. Like, he really thought he was going to be able to get along in Honduras without speaking any Spanish.
Right. Right. So after the Cooper hijacking and the subsequent copycat hijackings, Aviation Authority and the FBI realized that they had really far too relaxed security in America on domestic flights.
Definitely so, if this was a thing that kept happening.
Hundreds of times. The first step to prevent the hijackings was introducing full baggage security checks for the first time. This might seem unbelievable in 2024, but the issue had been, you know, passed through the U.S. courts in 1973, and American passengers thought the searches were violations of their rights. But eventually, it was deemed necessary to protect those on board, and it became mandatory for all those to be, you know, the bags to be scanned and for the cockpit door to be locked.
Yeah, definitely that. Jesus.
So the copycats are kind of interesting, I think. So one of the common themes in all the different copycats and all the different theories about who actually D.B. Cooper was, they all start with one of the flight attendants saying, when asked to describe this person, it was a middle-aged white man. But what if it wasn't?
Okay.
So there's one theory. Barbara Dayton had undergone gender reassignment surgery in 1969. Apparently, at some point, she confided in someone on her deathbed that she was actually D.B. Cooper.
Oh, my God.
So how, you might say? Well, the surgery happened in 1969. This happened in 1971. What if this woman by the name of Barbara Dayton
was masquerading as a man?
Before the surgery, she would have had some recollection of how to carry themselves and how that would be different in it and that sort of thing. And what to look like and dress like and so on. Now, think about this for just a second. Because they always say very debonair, slender, right?
Right.
Slender and sophisticated looking and so on and so forth. What if it was
a trans woman?
A trans woman.
Wow. That would be interesting. And she admitted to this on her deathbed. It was a deathbed confession.
So there's a gentleman named Gregory Gray, Jeffrey Gray, and he did a thing called Skyjack, the D.B. Cooper story. And it includes a story about Barbara, the aviation enthusiast, World War II veteran, merchant marine, and, wait for it, parachutist.
Oh.
Who died in 2002, may have been the first person to undergo gender surgery, reassignment surgery in 1969. Dayton purportedly made a bold confession to her friend Ron Foreman and Ron Foreman's wife, claiming that 2 years after undergoing gender reassignment surgery, Dayton boarded a plane and, while presenting as a male, altered her voice, carried out the greatest unsolved aviation heist ever. Dayton, who'd been denied a commercial pilot's license, allegedly sought revenge on the airline and the industry.
Oh, my God.
With the act and proclaimed to have hidden and stolen the money in a cistern in Woodburn, Washington, Oregon, and gone back and gotten it later.
That's wild. Okay, but why did someone else find the money?
Perhaps.
A little bit got loose.
Perhaps she hid some of it just for the purpose of throwing people off. She hid $5,000 or $5,600, which in today's money is, you know, much more than that. But compared to $200,000, what's $5,000?
Wow.
What if she buried it on a bank, partly covered, and hoped someone would find it and say, look, he died where he fell here.
Wow.
So that's a
theory.
That's a theory. That is really a theory.
That's a wild theory.
So, but anyways, you know, we'll never know. There's even a fact that one of the gentlemen we mentioned earlier, Rick McCoy, said that his dad, Richard McCoy, you know, who had done other skyjackings before,
oh my God,
was actually cooperated with his wife, who was near the point of where he would have landed and had an automobile or something like that, picked him up. So they were able to get away that way. Right. And he said that he had told his son that that's what had happened, but he didn't say anything. The son didn't say anything until now, he claims, because he didn't want his mom to be implicated as, you know, as, mm-hmm. you know, someone in the heist as well. So, she died in December of 2020.
Wow. Right?
Yes. So we may never know exactly what happened to D.B. Cooper.
I wonder why the child came forward at all.
Well, that's just it. I mean, the child came forward.
Why?
Because he found the money. And, you know, I don't know. My dad always said, you know, if I found money.
No, not that child. I'm talking about the child who said that their dad did it, who is now an adult.
I know. But what if you knew one of the biggest secrets of all time? Right. And you knew what happened. Right. This is a huge secret. It's never been solved. The FBI, the only aviation case that's never been solved, threw up their hands.
It's not even like, it's not a murder or a sexual assault.
Maybe
like, it's literally
just,
oh, maybe. Yeah, I could see that. Actually, that makes sense.
Because D.B. Cooper spawned a lot of different things. I mean, there have been so many movie plots and books and everything written about where the character, you know, jumps out of a plane with all the money and so on. Even though physically, that would be a real crapshoot. You know, my thought is it's none of these things. And this person jumped into 100-mile-an-hour winds coming out of the back of a plane and, you know, probably fell to their death. And the parachute never opened. And that's what you found the money.
Not the parachute never opened. Oh, my gosh.
Well, I mean, the thing about a parachute, you're relying on the fact that it captures that envelope of air. But if you're in a thunderstorm or something like that, and it was icy, it was cold. The wind was blowing, you know, very likely that a person jumping out, especially one that didn't have a steerable parachute, would fall to their death.
Wow.
So maybe that happened. And maybe we'll never know.
I think we will probably never know. And people just keep trying to jump on.
Or jump
on
out.
The bandwidth. Oh, my gosh. Literally. So cheesy.
I know. But anyways, that, Caroline, is the story of D.B. Cooper.
Not Debbie Cooper.
Maybe.
Follow the show on whatever streaming site you're listening on.
And remember, all of the source material will be available in the show notes.
And follow us on Instagram at What We Lose in the Shadows. And let us know if you want to hear a specific case.
Or if you just want to give us some feedback.
Okay, join us in the shadows next Tuesday. Bye.